Why don't we get started? For those who don't know me, I'm Graham Reside, and this is my daughter Anna. She's one of the reasons that I've been thinking about development, human development a lot. I have another daughter who's three. She's here as well, and I'm living with in a house of children of all various ages, all the way up to 49, I believe. This week I want to talk about stages of development. And last night we talked about most of our time talking about the last stage. And I borrow the language from Eric Erickson, a psychologist. He talked about generativity, that human beings, when they are at their fullest development, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, they are in a generative stage, he said. And he used that word to describe the creativity, the connection to generations, right? The sort of continuity through time, giving birth, whether it's actually literally or giving birth to institutions, organizations, that really requires a sort of generative set of gifts and skills in order to accomplish some of those things. Another way for me to think about it is doing some of those things has forced me to be a little more generative. So having a child is, as I said last night, has been the best antidote to my own narcissism. It's helped me grow up. And similarly, being invited into an institution, whether it's church or my job, invites me to grow up and to be more adult. So I wanted to talk this week and tonight about stages of development. And I want to think about this notion of generativity as a kind of vocation. A vocation, the word vocation, I know you, I'm Presbyterian, you Lutherans are pretty kept to vocation too, right? In fact, may have really got a head start on us Presbyterians. But the word means vocare, it comes from vocare, to call. So to what are you called? And often when people talk about vocation, they're thinking about their work. What line of work are you called? But Eric Erickson and others want to suggest it's a way of life. It's a way of being in the world, an agent of God in the world. And generativity describes a certain way of being in the world. And last night we talked about some of the qualities of generativity. And I don't have an exhaustive list, but some of them were creativity. Right? I ask people to think, when was a time when you were really, really in the flow state or in the zone, where you were really, you did something and you felt like you really knocked it out of the park? And describe yourself at that time. And words that came up were words like creative, innovative, able to work well with teams. And so these are some of the elements that we strive for. And then the question is, why aren't we like that more often? And so then I want to raise this notion of the fact that developmental theory says human beings progress through a set of stages. But that, in fact, all these stages are in us as adults. And that it's quite easy for us to get triggered back to an earlier stage, that it's actually very difficult to live out of a generative stage. The other kind of interesting piece, I think, is that I'm glad we have a scientist, a biologist in the room, but human beings naturally develop to a certain stage. It's kind of part of our biological makeup. Children will learn to speak, right, whether we teach them or not. If they're in the environment, they're going to pick up speech. But Erickson and others suggest once you get to about age 21, if you're going to continue to develop, you have to work at it. It's not just a natural progression. It requires a kind of work. And I think religious traditions are on to this. We have notions of spiritual direction, Christian education, formation, that continue into adulthood. So that's, in general, the kind of tack that I want to take tonight and this week. And I have some PowerPoint slides, but I have no way of projecting, so I'm going to look at them to guide my conversation, if that's okay with you. And I'll tell you what they say. my daughter is actually here because she's on one of the slides. So you won't get to see that one.
Just
but, you
hold it.
Hold I'll hold it out. Right. Yeah. Do that? All right. Okay. So, as I said, there's nothing particularly insightful about what I'm going to tell you, because you've all either been a child, had a child, or know a child. So it's all pretty intuitive stuff, but these theorists, developmental theorists, organize it in a particular way. So I want to talk about that a little bit with you. And so the objective for tonight is to introduce developmental theory again, and then to just cover the first two stages. And I'm going to introduce you to a five-stage model. There's several different models of human development, and the one that I want to introduce you to is a five-stage model that contains elements of cognitive, emotional, ethical, and spiritual development. And for the week, it's to cover all five stages. 5 days, 5 days. So a common mistake that we make, and I've alluded to this already, is that when we're engaging people during the course of our day, whether it's at home, at work, with our loved ones and intimates, we think we're dealing with adults. But in fact, we are dealing with adult bodies that can at any moment incarnate different stages, children at different stages of their life. And not only are we dealing with people like that, we are ourselves like that. And I hope that means with some sense of familiarity that you know what I'm talking about. It's easier to see it in other people's, I think. Okay, so I want to think about these stages, and the five stages that I would sort of chart is the first stage is, I call it enforcer. It's 0 to 3 years of age, roughly. So we call that enforcer, and I can explain why in a minute. The second stage is, scorekeeping, and that's 4 to about 10 years of age. The third stage we call peacekeeping, and this is early adolescence into early adulthood, so we could say 14 to 20. And the last, then the next stage we call rebel producing, and this is early adulthood, basically through college, and then the final stage is generative. And I do think it's that our institutional life, the way we organize our education, actually maps onto these stages pretty well. You know, college, we divide schools almost by these stages. So you have elementary school for kids who are, you have preschool for kids who are in the enforcer stage. And actually, they often stay home, historically they stay home, because nobody wants to deal with an enforcer. I'll explain why. But then you have preschool and then elementary school up until about the age of 10, and then middle school, that we call peacekeeping age. And then high school is early adolescent, and then college. I want to think about these stages, if it helps, I can write them down, in terms of a few sort of internal categories. So I said enforcer. Sorry. Thinking. Feeling. How they get their needs met, or what I'll call power. So how do they get their needs met? Should have added this first. What is the fundamental need at this stage? And what is their level of commitment? What can we expect from them in return? So if we just think about 0 to 3, what would you say about the way 0 to 3-year-olds think?
Not too much.
Not too much.
Concrete, really concrete.
Yeah, they actually call it episodic. It's a sort of technical term. That they aren't able to connect thoughts one to another. They have a thought, and they have another thought. But they don't really connect thoughts one to another. Again, these are fairly a little bit stereotypical, but I think in general they give a good sense. Episodic. How might you, if I ask you about their feelings, what comes to mind for 0 to 3? should have brought my other job.
Emotionally dependent on either a parent or some adult figure.
Okay, so they're highly dependent. I'll get down to that probably at need and commitment.
They're immediate.
They're
whatever
immediate.
They feel.
So feelings are immediate, and they don't reflect upon the feelings. They just have them.
Thinking and feeling are totally one and the same almost at that age, it seems like.
Okay. So thinking and feeling is hard to separate, and they are immediate, we could say. Is that the word you used, Sonia?
Mm-hmm.
Immediate.
And they're not hiding their feelings.
Right. I mean, there's one nice thing about a kid is they're not dissembling. A kid at this age, they're not dissembling. That does change. But they're not dissembling at this age. If they're having a feeling, it's immediate. And one of the nice things that I, if I was teaching a parenting class, I would remind parents that not only are they not dissembling, they can't dissemble, and so they're not trying to manipulate you. They're just having that emotion. Sometimes parents think their kids are trying to manipulate them, and so they resist it. But actually, I think that the evidence suggests, no, you should meet that need, because it's a real need that they're having, and the feeling is not some effort to manipulate you, but it's to communicate. Because they can't communicate. Let me go to need. The fundamental need of a newborn to 3 years old really is safety and survival. Right? So they're actually very vulnerable. And of all the species, human beings have probably the most prolonged period of real serious vulnerability. So the need here is survival and safety. And one of the things that will continue through all these stages that I want to hold up is the idea that I'm providing a developmental model stage, right? But each of us is unique. So we all go through these stages, but we go through them with our own unique scripts. We talked about this a little bit last night. So our scripts can activate us as adults to be more likely to retreat to one of these situations. So let's say, as a very early child, your sense of survival and safety was really up for grabs, or at least you felt it was. When you get older, if you have that sense, it returns you to a very primitive mode, right? If you feel that your survival is at stake, you return to a primitive mode, and that moves to the next thing. How do we get our need? How do children, infants, get their needs met? Noise. Right. So it's something. It's pretty much rage. It's rage, right? So it's really a pretty basic mechanism, fight or flight, I would say. So they will withdraw. Kids will give up on you and withdraw, or they'll just scream their bloody head off.
Mine too.
So it's fight or flight. And again, I take some cold comfort in this reality with my own 3-year-old, because not an hour ago, she was screaming. And then whatever the issue was, I met it. And it's completely gone. Right? Because there's not a real sense of time. She can't, she doesn't hold a grudge yet. And she can't hold things across time. So it's fight or flight. Once she gets her needs met, the arms come down. She stops punching me. In the groin, by the way. Okay, and the level of commitment that they are capable of is functionally zero. But then again, we don't expect 0 to 3-year-olds to commit to us. And if we do, there's something wrong with us. That we commit to them, they don't commit to us. So their ability to commit is zero.
Can you define commitment better? I mean, because in my mind, I mean, they stick with you.
It's a bonding.
Yeah. So that's a kind of a commitment. So how is your definition?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit stereotypical here. I guess I would say they're sticking with you because you have what they need. And I don't want to overdo it. I actually think that our babies love us, but it's not a sophisticated moral relationship. It's a pretty simple needs-based relationship, and the fundamental need is survival and safety. And if I can change the metaphor to dogs, because I'm a little uncomfortable saying this about children, a dog will easily go to another family if you meet its basic needs.
But a child won't.
Right. Yeah, it's a little more complicated. But I think that's because it's such a physiological relationship. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, I think fundamentally it's not a moral relationship.
But then why would there be all that attachment theory, you know, or therapy that people do that to help kids attach or come back out of the womb and
right.
all that?
Well, this is 0 to 3, and the fact of the matter is, as Kohlberg says, that the number one thing a kid needs at this stage is to know that the world is trustworthy. So trust is the thing that we should give them, which is to say, yes, the world is safe, and I am here to make sure that you will survive.
Well, and I think you're positing that commitment requires a kind of intentionality and agency. So it's a particular kind of understanding about commitment, which an infant wouldn't have, even though there's definitely a connection. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's not a connection.
Or an attachment.
Yeah, right. Well, that's definitely there. But
since you are in it, then you need the attachment later. So a dog never comes out of this phase. But like you were saying before, if your needs aren't met at this stage, and then later on your survival is threatened, you retreat back to here.
Right.
So you need that attachment so that those needs are met, so that later on you don't go back.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
I guess I would argue that their commitment is not zero. Their commitment is instinctual. Like it's just, you know, like a newborn will prefer to look at their mother's face over another woman sitting next to their mother. I don't know. I guess it depends on what we believe about physiologically based bonding and psychologically or emotionally based bonding and all that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm
probably
a sociologist.
Sorry, that probably hinges on survival. Somehow we're, you know, our emotional connection as an infant to the mother's face, that one particular human being is most likely one to take care of us, right? So it's kind of, I mean, even the emotional attachment would be serving the need of survival, because that's the person you should be emotionally attached to.
If you attach to that attachment to physiologically based, I mean, that's still saying. I guess I'm just saying, what about the huge mystery of attachment that's not explained by face, you know, with getting your needs met, that, I don't know, that love is in that group and
sure.
God is in that group.
Sure.
But,
no, I would disagree. I'm happy to move to instinctual. Zero, even as I read it, seemed a little
hard.
My wife is not here. to correct me. Yes.
I'm not quite yet getting why they're called the enforcer.
Oh, because how they force their, it's through enforcement. And really, this is when an adult reverts to this stage. They rage, and how they get their needs met is through force and violence. And in fact, yeah, I should have been clear with that. So as I said last night, you know, if you were in corporate America, at least in a lot of corporations, if you're going to be downsized, if you're going to be fired, and you show up on Thursday to find out that your job is gone, there's often a security guard to escort you out of the building. Because they're worried, they know instinctively, that your survival and safety needs may be up, right? May feel, you know, at stake, and that you might go postal. Right? So there is a kind of awareness, I think, that people do get triggered back here. It tends to be men. And I don't know what that's about. Although it's probably about stereotypical gender relationships where men are expected to provide, so if they lose their job, you know, there's a lot at stake. Okay, but let's move to the next stage, which we could call the call it Sparky. Okay, so we think about the way they think, feel, what they need, the deploy power and commitment, what we can expect in return. Another way, let me just, one other thing about commitment. Narcissism in a 0 to 3 year old is considered healthy, right? So the kind of narcissistic sense is what is expected in a 0 to 3 year old. It's not expected in a 40 to 43 year old. So in that sense, I would say the commitment that you can expect back is the commitment that you can expect back from a narcissist. And if you've ever had a relationship with a narcissist, that at least points to what I'm trying to get at. They're not very good at commitment. Okay, so just can't seem to let that go. Okay. how do kids in this age think? Anyone? Chris, you actually use the technical term that often gets used at this stage. You don't even remember.
No.
You say concrete literal, right? Mm-hmm. So they tend to think in concrete literal terms, which means with most kids, at least at the earlier stage, you can give them you can trade them a nickel for a dime, right? Because they're concrete literal. They see the nickel. Oh, it's bigger. It must be more than I. So you can trade a nickel for a dime, and you can make a lot of money that way. So they tend to be concrete literal. They're not great at metaphorical thinking and analogies. But you can see that throughout this, and again, kind of common sense, that these stages build upon one another. And this is based on Piaget's theory of cognitive development. How do they feel? What would you say about their feelings?
Hey, Graham, mm-hmm. Earlier in John Wallace's session, that whole thing
fell.
And so why don't you move your computer out of the way just in case it decides to dive? It'd be much less expensive.
Thank you.
And you're over on the side. All right, I'm comfortable.
Totally giving up on that.
I'm comfortable now.
Okay. So I'm sorry, we were talking about feeling. How do these young people... Anyone? Maris?
No, like they I think they can recognize some kind of acceptable emotional reactions to things and not. I mean, you're less time, you're, you know, timeouts, and then they go, they understand behavior a little bit, right and wrong, and I don't know if that's what you mean by
that,
but they begin to acknowledge that there's a, you know, group way to play nice together. And
yeah, my kids are both in that age range, and they have a strong sense of fairness, a sense of, you know, who's getting what and why and who deserves to get what.
Others are in the picture.
They do need to, there's a sense of fairness, right? And they want to know, well, let's go to need. What's the basic need of a 6 to 10 year old? What do your kids need?
Emotional stability and security.
Okay. What else? At this stage, they're starting to consolidate a self. The theory says that they need self-worth, that they need to feel that they are being worthwhile. Because here there is no self, really. They have no self-awareness. They are, in some sense, an extension of the mother still. But here they're starting to differentiate, and they need to know that differentiated self is worth something. Right. And what did you say, Heidi? They need to feel secure?
They need emotional stability, yeah. Okay. Or security, emotional sense of well-being.
So, yeah, stability is important, and they become aware of the world of rules, right? Because it's don't do this, don't do that. The world becomes codified into a set of rules, and this is largely what kindergarten teachers are doing, is bringing, inducting these children into a rule-based world. It was actually a little shocking.
You could almost call scorekeeper rule-keeper.
Yeah, rule-keeper. And again, I guess the slightly pejorative terms here, because I use these categories to talk with adults about their behaviors when they resort to these stages. So, how do they deploy power? That's what they need, that's for sure.
I don't know, I've got an arguer.
Okay.
You know, he keeps saying he's going to be a lawyer, so a rational argument is his way of overpowering me.
Right. They negotiate. Negotiate. And they the world is a zero sum game, right? And they want to get theirs. Mm-hmm. There is a sense of justice and fairness. The world's a pie. There's only so many pieces. They want to get their piece of pie. And sometimes, because there's a sense that there may not be enough to go around, they'll dissemble, they'll lie, and they'll cheat to get what they want. And when I say they, I mean adults too. So they'll dissemble and lie, which again, I don't think you'll see in kids at this age. But now, manipulation is a possibility. And commitment, they're committed to the relationship as long as it's working out for them. So kids are notorious, my daughter's not here yet, are notorious for getting along with somebody as long as it's fun, and as soon as it's not fun, they're gone.
But then they'll often, that person can come right back half an hour later,
sure.
And it's like they never had any sort of disagreement at all.
Right, right. So they're committed as long as it's working for them.
Situational commitment.
Okay. So, in the adult world, this is really the world of Hobbesian world of all against all, right? And we're willing to make social contracts with one another in order to get our needs met. But it is, in fact, a world of, it's not a world of violence, so it's not a world of enforcement. But it's a world that is only protected from violence by social agreements, by laws. So those laws have to be respected. They are what give order to the world. And in fact, you know, Lawrence Holberg has a theory of moral development, and I apologize if you were here last night because I used this example last night, but his famous test for children's moral development is the Heinz Dilemma. It's a story about a man whose wife is dying, and he needs to get medication from the pharmacist, but he has no resources to do so. So Kohlberg says, should he steal? And almost inevitably, kids in this phase say no. The law says no. So it is an actual a shift in moral reasoning to say no. He should steal. He should consider stealing it. Because there's a greater good here. It's a larger moral universe. Here, the moral universe is defined by the rules. And, you know, that's no easy thing just to get the rules down. So I never did say, well, how do they feel? They have feelings, and they can start to reflect on them. Right? But they still are often in the grip of feelings more than...
Aren't they defining feelings a lot at that point, too?
Right.
Naming them.
They can start to name their feelings.
It seems also there's a lot of compassion in kids' feelings at this age, where they love dogs and cats, and you know, they've got their best friend that they're, you know, forever, you know, that one.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience. This is my first time through.
You got a lot of agreement on the one on the floor here.
Okay. We had a preacher here three weeks ago, who said, in the sermon, your healing journey begins when you're addressed by a love that you don't deserve. And it would seem that a scorekeeper could hear that.
Right. They're starting to get that they're bad. Right. Yeah, actually, I meant to say one of the things is that they are able to experience guilt.
I don't know, but
I mean, if they're a scorekeeper, they couldn't make sense of a love that they didn't deserve. If they're...
That's what I was wondering. If,
I mean, it seems like this would be the age where they wouldn't get that. I'm not sure. I mean, a scorekeeper would say, well, I've done good, so I deserve it. I've been bad, so I don't deserve it. But would they really understand somebody's going to love me anyway? Maybe through their parents, through experiencing that with their parents, who say. But I don't know if you're using scorekeeper as the primary descriptor.
Well, I would just say, if we think about, again, I'm a sociologist, so when actually do kids come to Jesus? I don't know in the Lutheran church, but I can tell you in my evangelical background, it's at 13 and 14.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I see them come to Jesus every day, and in third grade. I mean, that's what I don't like about. I think these are helpful, but to me, they have a huge caveat on them. Is that they're artificial stages that have some truth, but they're not all the truth.
Sure.
And there's exceptions to all of them. And a child at any age can feel an overwhelming sense of God's presence that doesn't fit in any category. And I mean, I don't think that, of course. I mean, I admire Kohlberg and Piaget and Erickson and everybody else, but they're limited. So we make these, like, divide things up just to when we all get older, then we have to put them all back together. It just seems like now if we just realize that they were already not concrete, that we would have some trouble later when we...
Yeah, I mean, this is only a heuristic
tool,
but obviously I'm fairly persuaded around what you're presenting, that we do, certain operations have to happen before, certain skills have to be mastered before our skills can be learned. As I said last night, you have to get basic math before you can get calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And Piaget especially, I think, is sort of the cognitive operations that have to be mastered before the next one can be...
Could you maybe say instead that... they do the same thing, only they do it differently?
Sure, I mean, that's exactly right.
The 3-year-old loves, the 4-year-old loves more so or in a more advanced manner.
Right, it goes from simple
still
to
does.
Complex is really, and I wouldn't want to, I hope the notion of commitment didn't throw you off. I mean, love, I suppose, is a kind of commitment, but I'm really going to think about that, whether a 0-3-year-old can love in a kind of moral way. I resist that for some reason, but
they certainly have preferences.
Yeah.
About objects and people and food and everything else. Is that the same as love?
My 3-year-old, of course, she's at the far end, so you could say she certainly hates things. Yes.
Dan Erlander preaches a sermon occasionally in which he identifies the central original sin, he's talking about the garden, original sin is keeping score. That when we learn to keep score is when sin enters our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how this how this jives with the 4-10-year olds.
Yeah.
You understand that you know what he's saying,
well,
right?
Yeah.
It's good and evil, it's you against me, it's...
Well, I mean, heaven and hell start to make sense to kids at a certain
right.
stage.
But grace doesn't.
Right. Yeah.
Grace doesn't make sense to kids?
Not if you're a scorekeeper.
Except if God breaks in somehow.
We don't deserve it.
Right.
But kids 4 to 10 get a lot of stuff they don't deserve, both good and bad.
Yeah.
They've experienced that.
But it's not fair.
But do they really think that they don't deserve it would be my question. Mm-hmm. I mean...
I'm engaging, I think, parents here, right? and I'm used to engaging adults who recognize themselves in this. I do take this very seriously. That these are really just broad strokes to say this is generally what we can see, but I wouldn't want to say this is how human beings develop. No, I mean, here's a story. Do you find it persuasive? As I would say, rent to own it, and you can leave it at the door on the way out.
So is this more about describing adults then? Is that what you're saying then?
No, but I'm just saying adults, when they think back, they tend to recognize themselves in it. Because they're not remembering everything about their own childhood. They're remembering the episodes, and that sometimes the deep feelings or the unmet needs, I think, is what they tend to remember.
One of the fascinating things to me is watching the way
neuroscience is beginning to substantiate some of the psychological theories about what capacities people at certain ages have. Like the whole effort to try and think about when adolescents have forethought, when they can anticipate negative consequences, and the increasing clarity about the fact that they can't or don't have that capacity is driving state legislatures to raise the driving age and et cetera, because it really is a worry that we're asking something that's not really physiologically possible in the same way it is for, say, a 25-year-old.
Sure.
So.
Hang on. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say that I think one of the reasons we're fascinated with it is because it does ring rather true. And Piaget, I had an older sister who spent her first 3.5 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And I know when, I think when our family first, as a younger brother, but when we were first, when we first read a lot of this, I thought, wow, she, when I first came on the scene, she was a scorekeeper. But the stories about her as one of the survivors of this Japanese, especially when the kids have survived, so much of it rang true. And so maybe I don't think it has to be personal, but it is personal. It is particular. And so when adults say, oh, I remember that. Every time I see this again, oh, yeah, I remember that myself. I remember my sister.
Right. Thank you.
It's well, stories about it.
Let me just, I'm just thinking about this again, as part of the event. I'm here on my own with my kids. And it's not entirely true because I have friends helping me when they're in this room. But, you know, at this age, I'm continually saying to Miriam, who's 3, tell me anything. And she's hitting me. I'm luring her forward. I'm saying, tell me how you feel. Put words to those feelings. So this is giving her an opportunity to sort of actually calibrate her emotions and think, well, okay, what am I feeling? Is it anger or resentment? I don't think she's got that fine a calibration yet. But you know, if I could just get her to stop punching me and say, I'm angry, Dad, or, you know, I'm mad at you, and why? I mean, that's what we do as parents, right? We try to get them to name. Tell me. Use your words. So I think that's probably true. Well, she's too young. Maybe it's stuff.
But isn't it true that earlier we say to them if they seem sleepy or hungry or happy, you say, you're sleepy now, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we begin to give them the words.
Yeah.
Because they can't use them until.
And they say, no, I'm not.
Yeah. As they're nodding.
Yeah, no, that's true, though.
Okay, let me go to one of my slides. I did want to.
The grandson
and point out something.
Seven,
but I think it's worth saying that one of the key themes through these stages is the need, right? All needs, all human beings are needy, and I think we sometimes forget how profoundly needy we are. As I said earlier, we are, of all the species, have the most prolonged, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the most prolonged sort of sense, period in which we are utterly dependent upon our families and our social environment. So these needs are really basic. But when I work with people, they're really reluctant to talk about what they need. And the other thing about needs that I tell them, I believe this, is that needs are fundamentally innocent. They're value neutral. There is no bad need. How you go about getting those needs met can be bad.
But showing weak needs shows weakness, and we're not supposed to do that.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes it's a real mistake to show your needs, right? It depends on the environment. But I think one of the points of church is to be a context in which we can actually be needy.
Isn't part of the definition of concupiscence or original sin inordinate need, which would imply that there are bad needs if they're inordinate? It's not bad to need survival, but it may be bad to need it so much that you're willing to cut short the survival of other beings, other creatures, the earth,
sure,
because we want more, more, more.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, when you talk about there's no bad need, do you mean basic needs for survival?
That's the distinction between needs and wants. And that we've expanded the definition of needs beyond what it actually is.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess I would just go with the from your class this morning, the Augustinian approach to needs, right? Which is precisely, there's nothing wrong with needing survival and safety. But if we can use the metaphor, we talked about it last night again, but I was going to say some, but I'll own it. I think that our national reaction to 9/11 was not right, right? It was too much. It was inordinate to the challenge to our basic safety and survival. But it was because our survival and safety was at stake for people that we have become less than generative, and might certainly we've gone to scorekeeper, if not enforcer, right? I mean, there's some enforcing going on at Guantanamo Bay, if the stuff that I've read is to be believed. So it's really quite fascinating to me to think about this in, you know, less personal terms and less familiar terms, but in sort of national terms, the way that when survival became at stake, whom, the developmental stage really, you know, went down, right? I think that we started to act out of, not all the time, and I don't want to overdo it, but there was some enforcement. It's easiest to be generative when things are going well. And in fact, we get triggered back into earlier stages under conditions of stress, anxiety, and tiredness. That's when we human beings tend to trigger back. So I guess I think that I would still, I'll think about it. But
I think the need-want distinction pretty much answers. I mean, if you're defining need as things we actually need for survival. Yeah.
Well, not just survival, because I'm going to show that at each stage, so you need work when you are a scorekeeper.
Yeah.
But if it's an inordinate demand for the world to always to give you approbation, then yeah, that's a problem. That's not. There's something wrong there. Or we'll see later, belonging at the next stage. That's the demand. But when belonging then creates xenophobia or violence towards the other, then we can, I think, you know, I would go with Augustine that that's an inordinate response to what is a good, what is a fundamental good.
But then it really fits with what you were saying originally anyway, which is the need is not the problem, it's how we're trying to meet it. If we have a need for belonging, yet we try to meet it in such a way that it is obviously overreaching.
Mm-hmm. What?
I guess another way to frame the question is every evil act, does every evil act at its core have a need that is neutral and could be met in a non-evil way? And
yeah.
I'm not asking you to answer it, but I'm just, if we're getting to the basic idea that need is neutral, value neutral, then it would follow that even evil acts have at their core a need that is neutral.
Well, I think you've really run up against the real limits of this, for me, this model, because I think it was Alice Miller wrote a book about Hitler and talked about his childhood. But most people say, I don't want to hear about his childhood, right? You're not gonna justify, or not justify. No, she didn't seek to justify, but to explain the Holocaust because of the unmet needs, infant needs of this guy. Although it was an interesting account of a lot of deficiencies, but it does, I think, push that level of evil pushes against this theory.
With every theory, theories seek to take something incredibly complex and simplify it so we can understand it. But that doesn't make it simple.
Oh,
it's still complex, but it gives some sort of framework to discuss it.
Yeah, I just took your life and put it into 5 buckets.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you're satisfied with that, that's
fine. But I'm not sure that the theory falls apart because of that. It's just that here you have this thing that just doesn't fit because it is a complex We are complex people.
And I would guess that the theory is based on some research, and therefore the framework is helpful,
right,
as long as we don't then end up
hand-writing
everybody,
yes,
and becoming formulaic in how we live our lives or relate to other people. You know, I peg somebody as a scorekeeper, that's how I treat them.
Right.
That's not right.
But one nice, for me, one nice thing to do, one positive use of this kind of thing is, if I, as I said last night, to get curious instead of critical about people. So when you see someone acting in a way that they start to lie, and instead of saying, you son of a bitch, you're lying, what is the unmet, what's the need that's causing them to lie? I mean, that will only, may only get you so far. But it's or at least with self-examination, oh, I find myself lying again. What's that about? And then to be able to think, well, maybe there's something more basic here, that the lie is actually a cover for an effort to meet, an inappropriate effort to meet something that is okay. And so then if I can think, okay, what do I need? How can I get that met in a more appropriate way? You know,
you could think about, take the example of getting into a good college and what I perceive to be the rising pressure among certain strata in our country to have their kids hyperachieve. And so that maybe extends this period. And so there's this problem with plagiarism and with cheating. There was this huge case in Hanover with New Hampshire because these kids broke, who were very high achieving kids in high school, headed to really good colleges, broke in to get the master test for a chemistry exam so that they could all get ace the test. And they got caught. And they had two of them turned 18, so they had charges pressed against them for breaking and entering and stealing.
Yeah.
But the whole thing was driven, I would say, partly based on this, on this hyper pressure upon their self worth only being achieved by getting the right score.
You sort of wonder at that point what level their parents are on.
You can also situate it in a larger social context where increasingly winner takes all.
Yeah.
Right? It is a social environment where if you get into that Ivy League school, you're going to make four times what that state school kid's going to make. Probably maybe more. I mean, it's an increasing divide and a winner take all society. And I think the data suggests that. So in some ways, we set up our institutions. At least we should be mindful of the way our institutions run, because they elicit particular kinds of behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think our Western culture particularly elicits rational and upholds the rational way of thinking. I think this kind of understanding is weighted on a rational understanding rather than a non-rational understanding. And I think it gets us into a lot of trouble when we get to the generative.
Mm-hmm. How much of this do you think is a product of a particular kind of society in a particular point in history? Is this about advanced industrial capitalist societies and not so much villages in Kenya?
You're saying these stages?
Yeah.
Most of the theorists insist that these are universal categories.
I know they do. What do you think?
I'm a sociologist and a culturalist, so and it looks a lot like an order of salvation, right? That this is a particular story about the good life.
But doesn't it make a difference? You know, the hierarchy of needs?
Yeah.
The difference, if your society is at that lower level, you can't get to some of this stuff.
Well, if you're a society, if, you know, if we're talking about a society that's not as stable, that those needs and that 0 to 3 aren't going to be met.
Right.
So that's going to change. I mean, that's what you're saying, you're not going to get beyond there, but that's going to change the whole development. If that doesn't build it out of anything else, if you're not.
Although there's also a piece of it where you read, like, in Three Cups of Tea about those kids who are, like, far beyond us, in my mind, in these stages, you know. They're going to school on their own, not in a building, writing with sticks on the dirt. I mean, that's very,
right.
You know, it's what they know, but it almost seems in some levels like they pass through some of this stuff and get to I don't know. Are you always in one stage in every area?
No, no. I mean, these are really, no, no. I don't think anyone, any of the theorists would argue that. These are just typologies that help understand.
Well, and do the age brackets grow bigger as humans live longer? I always reflect back on like the founding fathers. I look at Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. They did all their big accomplishments when they were younger than I am now. I'm 27. There's no way I could write the Constitution right now.
Right.
You know, but back then, they were old when you hit 27. You know, and does that mean that the enforcer used to be 0 to 2, and scorekeeper was 3 to 8, and then you were having kids at 13? And you know.
But we've extended it. We've extended our juvenileness in our society.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have. I mean, even formally, like our society, again, I said this last night, but the formal education period is prolonged.
Yeah.
You're still in school, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, a generation ago, that none of us would have been. I was in school in my late 30s. So that there's a prolonged adolescence, I think.
Oh, and we don't have a rite of passage that's defined either in our society.
Well, there's a book that's worth... Well, a couple things I'd say about other societies. One is simple to complex does not mean from bad to worse. From bad to good. It might mean that. It doesn't necessarily mean from bad to good. Right? So otherwise, you'd have to say our society is better than other societies. And I don't know how many people want to make that claim. But there is this, so from simple to complex, there are simple societies, or more simple societies. But there's a book by a psychologist out of Harvard, Robert Keegan. It's called In Over Our Heads, The Mental Demands of Modern Life. Mm-hmm. And the suggestion there, he's really only interested in cognitive development there, or mostly cognitive development. But he's saying the increasing complexity of our social life, we're not keeping up cognitively. And so it's taking a lot of work, and we're certainly not educating our young people to meet the new challenges, just of the complexity of it. In this sense, it's just our social situation might be pulling us into a level of cognitive complexity. And we could think socially, in simple societies, they don't have the same demands to be able to figure out, they don't need the same level of, let's say, emotional intelligence to figure out all the relationships that are going on if they only have family and work, or if family and work are combined.
But at the same time, we are backing away from our socialness. We are isolating. From our social situations. We isolate ourselves more and more. I mean, people go around with things in their ears, ignoring the rest of the world. And I think that's...
I think it's just a different form of connection.
It is.
If you're... I mean, they have just a whole bunch of alternative means of connection, including music. So it looks like isolation,
but you know what? Though?
I would argue there's a lot of complex social interaction that happens through the
I would
technology.
Argue there is and there isn't, but I think if you look, I mean, if you look from a planning perspective, how many of us live in suburbs where we open the garage door from our car, we drive in our garage, we close the garage door, and we're in our house. Mm-hmm. We have huge backyards, so we don't go to the park to play and meet our neighbors. So I think there is some. I think that's right. Maybe it's in response to all of these sort of demands that our society is placing on us.
We sit in our air-conditioned cars going down the road.
Mm-hmm.
We become our own little world when we're on the, you know, road rage.
So I think we need the connections. I think all the text messaging and stuff is trying to fill this void that we have.
Yeah.
But I would argue that it's not doing a very good job of it.
Yeah.
Don't knock the people that are listening.
Master
Duke. I worked for 35 years. It's wonderful to have to listen to that music instead of having a blast.
Yeah.
And they still do pay attention.
But at the same time, it might have been a bad example, but we do tend to isolate ourselves. And as old as I am, you can't hear anything but one.
I want to just change the subject a little bit. I was as a pastor, often thought a lot about what was the need in the text that happened to be for Sunday, and what was the promise And I would wonder in your typologies here, if you think about what kind of promise could be offered to an enforcer, to a scorekeeper, and that'd be thinking out of the box a little bit. But I, as a pastor, would want to, it's important to know the need, but it was also a gospel to address that need with something life-giving.
So who would be making the promise?
Maybe the person proclaiming, because church councils are full of scorekeepers.
I don't know, I'm just adding another category to the listing out there as to how would you address
I think that's, maybe this goes to your, I hope it answers in some way. I mean, I like that a lot, but one way would be, God can meet your need, right? So if your need is survival and safety, as a parent, as a church, the child knows that, hey, we've got that covered. God's got that covered. And so the appropriate message for a scorekeeper, whether it's an adult or child, is God, you are worthwhile to God. And maybe when you are, the next stage is peacekeeping, the adolescence, you belong to God, right? You belong to the church. And again, I don't know in your tradition, but in our tradition, it tends to be at that age that we take young people into membership in churches. So we do have some rituals around this. So I do like that. I don't know if that, is that?
Yeah, that begins to talk about it. And then the other thing I was thinking about was the earliest images of the church. How is Jesus portrayed as Savior? And certainly, I think the earliest images of Jesus as a shepherd, and that would certainly apply to a 0 to 3 year old, survival, safety, this compassionate shepherd holding a lamb.
But, well, and what the shepherd did to sheep.
So you think also promise in terms of visual image and
Well, I didn't realize how smart I was last night, but I started with the Gospel of John passage. I was looking for the live life abundantly and thinking generative, but in that passage, it's also there. I am the shepherd. I am the good shepherd, and there are sheep. There are wolves and thieves out to get you, but I've got that covered. So that, it worked pretty well in ways I wasn't aware of until you brought it up. So thank you. I like that image a lot.
Except there's all those people that Ingrid could profoundly attest to that didn't get, and we all know that, didn't get all those needs met. I don't know.
Yeah, babies get depressed. They
Their
needs don't get met. They quit crying and they just give up.
Right.
And failure to thrive. Babies drop. If they don't have love, they die.
Yeah. Well, so one of the ways I try to use this with adults is to say, okay, where do you tend to go to? Which stage do you tend to go to? And we haven't covered all the stages. I'll cover a couple more tomorrow night. Peacekeeping and rebel producing, right? What I call rebel producing is where you're separating yourself from your family, from belongings and what matters. It's showing that you are an autonomous individual self that's competent. And you're very productive, but you tend to be dismissive of other people. What is your default mode? And then to think, okay, what's going on there? Is there a need that wasn't met or isn't being met? Because you can take all of them in you right now. And how can we sort of address that so that you can start acting and living out of a more generative disposition? Because, finally, I think this is in some ways a virtue ethic. Generativity is a way of being in the world. It takes, that's why I actually like this model in some ways, because habits form over time. You develop this, you learn it. It takes some effort, and so I read it as a kind of virtue ethic. It has problems that I see, but I really like that idea of a promise and what might be the most helpful. It's a quarter after. I think that means either a bell's about to ring or it already rang, and I didn't hear it. Thanks for listening. I do have to show a picture.